Welcome, Theo. Thank you very much for joining me on this podcast.
It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's the podcast is actually called Conversations About Software Engineering. And I thought, like, what better start to this than inviting the best software engineer that I know and I had the long pleasure to work with over the course of 5 years, Theo.
Flattery will get you through the interview.
Yeah, setting the tone. But I thought we could just have this conversation about software engineering and just look at your long history and kind of the lessons you learned along the way and where you got to the place where you are. But before we do, I want to talk a little bit about your newest endeavors in the battery industry. So what makes a good steak for you?
What makes a good steak for me? That is, there's a lot of personal preference. Depends on the day of the week. A good beefy flavor, good marbling. You know, I like ribeyes. I like skirt steaks. I like picanha. I like pretty much everything. But, you know, 80% of it's the chef, but a solid 20% of it is the cow's job.
Yeah. So is there like something about the experience of meat and kind of the whole, yeah, the meal that draw you into the industry? And I think there is so much craftsmanship in there and like the relationship to nature that I found quite interesting. So is that kind of the package that you're also like looking for?
It is. I think there's a complicated proxy element to that. So the adventure started sitting on my porch drinking bourbon with my neighbors, and we were lamenting that the butcher shops in the area have either shut down or not impressed. And the large chain grocery shops in the United States have changed the way they deliver cut meat. They take meat. They took the butchers out of the shops and moved them to the warehouse so that they could consolidate and pay them all part-time instead of full-time. So most of the meat that comes into a butcher shop, into a, like a grocery store meat counter, is already cut. So it's very hard to get a custom cut of meat. You don't have like a full primal. You don't have half a cow in there to do the work with, or half a pig or anything like that. So if you want something odd, like a, you know, odd in this area, like a picanha or beef colette or entrecote or a bavette steak, or you want something specific off a pig, like a pork secreto, it's very difficult to get it in this region because that's all done. The chop shop is in the warehouse and they ship it all to the grocery store. And we were sad about that. And we thought we should open a butcher shop. Remains to be seen if that was a good idea, but I am very satiated. I do eat a lot of meat now. But I'm not actually, I mean, I'm a butcher in that I own a butcher shop, but I am not a super proficient meat cutter. I can break down an animal and I can cut it up, but the butchers that we've hired are truly take it to an art form. So I enjoy their craftsmanship and respect the fact that craftsmanship adds a lot to the process.
Yeah, that makes sense. So with this pre-cut meat, is the problem really that it should be like more fresh when it's kind of closer to the customer, or is it that you cannot order the right parts?
It's the parts more than anything. They tend to not have an extreme freshness problem. In fact, the quality of the meat from grocery stores is usually pretty good because they buy in such bulk. They can get the quality that they want. So even the really big chains here like BJ's and Costco, which are huge, they actually have really great meat. The problem is if you want a 1.5-inch thick ribeye, you can't get it. You only have 1-inch thick ribeyes, or you have 2-inch thick ribeyes. So there's, you know, if you want a prime rib is like the basic example of that, is that, you know, if I want a 7-bone prime rib roast, it's difficult to find that because they're all cut into like 3-bone or 4-bone parts before they come into the grocery store. So it's really about how the animal's sliced up.
Yeah. And what kind of farms do you get the meat to the shop, in your shop?
So we source the meat I would say about 60% of our meat to 80% of our meat comes from a local area within 50 to 100 miles of us. And then the other 20% is interesting. So it's really hard to get New Zealand lamb local. It's also hard to get Australian Wagyu or Japanese Wagyu local. So those come from afar. The chicken comes from a nice farm in Pennsylvania that is known for the special processing and handling after slaughter, and that they air dry it and air cool it instead of water cool it, which really makes it taste like European chicken. So if you've ever had chicken in the United States and you're like, what is this trash? This chicken tastes like the chicken you would just get normally in Europe. And then the pork comes from a farm that's about 45 miles away from here. We get a half a pig every week and cut it up. And, you know, every part is used, or we try to, which is great.
Yeah, it sounds good. We have some problems with regulation in Germany. There was a very family-owned butcher shop in the town where I live that had to close down last year, or the beginning of last year, I think, which was a tragedy. And the regulation was the problem. They couldn't fulfill the new standards that were required. But before that, we really had the full value chain, really local. I could see the cow sitting or standing on the lawn on the neighbor's yard. It was all local, and that we couldn't consume it. If you knew the right people, you could really get the exact meat that was never left the town, and that I always found extremely nice. Although I don't have that kind of developed taste for meat, but just this whole process and having the local experience together with some barbecue and whiskey, that's definitely a good time.
Yeah. Well, the regulations are complicated here. I won't say that they're problematic, but it's one of the reasons we don't slaughter animals. Because that requires U.S. Department of Agriculture supervision and oversight and things like that. And butchery is already gone through the slaughter process. So we get the animal cut in half or cut into sixths or whatever, and that comes in on a truck. And then we just do the cut down from there. But that's largely due to the complexities of running a slaughterhouse, which is very complicated in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. Theo, I know that you have managed to sneak in some software engineering into your new role. So maybe we can talk a little bit about this, because I found it quite interesting. So what did you do?
Well, I will say that I'm not sure I was ever really on the cutting edge of software engineering, but I would say that I was up there and you know, out front. So early adopter of a lot of languages, you know, coding in C and C++ and Rust and JavaScript and all of those things to build complex apps. And if you ever want to step back in time, truly, you can go into old style retail, where you have scales, weights and measures and points of sale system. I know that places like Shopify and places like Square have tried to innovate there and replace a lot of those systems. But when you start doing things like deli work, where you're weighing things by the gram or the ounce or what have you, the systems, there's not a large market for that. So those more evolved products don't really accommodate those needs very well. So you're left with some stuff that's interesting. It ends up being a hodgepodge of products that never really do what you want. And my expectations for automation in an industry are really there not to reduce workload as much as they are to increase consistency and reduce human error. Right. So if you're, you know, receiving inventory, you don't want lots of manual steps so that it's received incorrectly. Depending on who's doing it, they have their own quirks. That sort of thing. We want to be able to manage inventory processes, which, as you can imagine, is pretty complicated in a butcher shop, because we don't get ribeyes. We get, you know, export rib plate or something like that. We get a subprimal and we have to cut it up into pieces. And one of the things that comes out of that is a ribeye. So it, it you end up having inventory that you shrink out of inventory for internal use and then produce new types of inventory. And if you don't have that inventory right, you can't really sell it online. Really easy in the store because somebody walks up to the counter and says, do you have any ribeyes? And you say, no, but I can cut you some. Or yes, they're right there. But in an online store, you don't have that conversation. So you really need to be able to bridge the gap between the old style service and that sort of accurate inventory online. I will say we haven't solved that problem, but we're a lot closer than most organizations are. And that is a lot about automating the processes of doing that so that a butcher can not make mistakes in data entry, right? Because the last thing you want is somebody operating a knife who also in the US, what we have is HACCP plans, HACCP, which are basically critical control points in food safety. So, you know, a piece of meat comes out of the refrigerator. The refrigerator has to be between, 34 and 41 degrees. It can only sit out for a certain number of minutes. Once it's cut, it has to be, you want it in a cool area, has to go back. You may do reduce oxygen packaging, all this sort of thing, like shrink wrapped and sous vide and things like that are complicated. And you have a butcher who specializes in knowing how to do all of that stuff. And then you're asking them to make sure that the pounds and ounces of the items that they've just produced are accurate in the system right after they cut them, which is pretty insane. So what we want to do is be able to automate those systems. And as any software engineer knows, is that you did not build a product for me. Hopefully you have a back end that can accommodate what I want, but I really need to bridge that gap through API usage. And if you want to step back in time, we use four different products for that. Square, we are starting to adopt more, has an excellent API, great documentation. The other three are tragic tire fires.
So Square is a payment system, right?
Or Square is a point of sale payment system, retail system, inventory management system. They do a lot of different stuff. I think they do HR as well, like the payroll and things like that too.
Oh yeah, that makes sense.
But we use a company called IT Retail, which powers a whole bunch of point of sale systems that are a weights and measures. And that's sort of one of their sweet spots is dealing with scales and things like that. The product sort of works. The API is undocumented and can change at any time. I believe the backend is written in SAP database. It's distributed, which is really interesting. It's kind of neat tech, but the product development, the software engineering on their side does not adhere to modern standards for what people want to consume. We use another product called Local Express, which really doesn't have a public API either. They've been great to work with, but it's just difficult to do anything automated at all. And you never know when the API is going to change because it's there to power their React app,
Yeah.
And then we use a set of scales in the environment from a South Korean company called CAS, C-A-S, which apparently has 32-bit Windows DLLs and headers that look like they're from 1980, documented in Korean. So those are the systems that we need to glue together in a way that both reduces workload, increases consistency, reduces human error, and one of the important parts is reduces turnaround time for change. So if you change the price of an item, that it shows up in the scales without waiting for tomorrow morning to reload the scales, which is pretty common in those environments, is that you've got this Windows app that you load an Excel file into or a CSV file into, and then you flush the scales and you really reload them all and do that every morning. And the old school people, they just punch the digits in the front and it's insane. I mean, they spend hours a day reprogramming their POUs, their product lookup codes into the system for all their items. It's just kind of wild. You look at it and you're like, are you crazy? Like, you want me to do what? So as a software engineer, you're like, I am not doing that but once, and I'm going to do it in code, and then we're just going to run that from now on.
So that was the kind of setting. You have your butchers that are on staff that need to kind of operate the ways and some machines and also like maybe some price. scales, and then they get inventory and they need to like register what they got. And then you have Square, which has a decent API, modern SaaS service, two SaaS services, which are like either SAP or not really have a like an API at all. And then this scales. Other scales, like physical things that have like come just with like a USB thing, or is it also a SaaS?
The scales are all physical devices that are typically over serial. But
serial.
The scales that we have do have TCP/IP network cards in them. So fancy, fancy.
Yeah.
We can talk to them over the network. At least they're not like, you know, old school, you know, Windows stack.
Yeah.
At least they're TCP/IP.
So,
and then there's actually one surprising curveball is that we use Unify. Ubiquity. So we use that because they have a pretty wide product offering that's pretty good for small scale business.
Yeah.
Cameras, Wi-Fi, you know, internet, all that kind of stuff, telephones, and they have display stuff. So they have a little device you plug into a TV. No API. It's insane.
Really?
So that's one of the parts that we have failed so far to automate is that like I can't update the pictures on the screen automatically.
Yeah.
Somebody has to like load their app, and the cell phone app doesn't allow you to do everything that the computer, the web does. So like there are certain things that like if you've got your phone on the road, you can't do. It is for a company like Ubiquity, which is what I would say a very interesting modern look at do-it-yourself business networking.
Yeah.
It's surprisingly ill-equipped to handle any sort of automation.
Yeah, that's sad. I think after like a inspiration from you, I also like wired everything up with Ubiquity here. So what also kind of works with them is remote administration of my mother's network and this kind of things.
But 100%.
I have never tried to like automate things fully with it. But yeah, it's sad that they don't have an API. But in that kind of environment, I mean, I think most software engineers would just give up and look for something else. Or, I mean, it's very hard to make progress. Probably I would look at some kind of UI automation that I kind of simulate browser clicks with Playwright or something. But you went another way.
Yeah. So the CAS scales are a Win32 app.
Yeah.
So that's a pain. They were very cooperative. I wrote them and said, look, I'm really trying to do something here. Can I have the code? And they're like, here's some DLLs. They are 32-bit, unfortunately, not 64-bit. But after about a month of work in Rust, I did manage to get all of it to work with the correct structure packing and everything to match the Windows structures that they're Windows C API stuff. So I'm able to like reload and program the scales and all of that kind of stuff. And it's all automated. So like, and then we use MailChimp, all these things get glued together. So we pull all the customer. So I had to reverse engineer all of the APIs out of IT Retail and Local Express and write SDKs for them. Like they're fairly minimal. And then everything gets tied together.
So for the DLLs, did you throw them into Jitra or something like this? Some like disassembly tool or like how did you
no,
get
no,
this
No, I use Rust to load the DLLs and run the DLLs. It's just that the APIs expect the structures that are passed in. You pass in like an array of structs and they have to be packed a very specific way.
Yeah.
And the header is not, I don't even know what compiler they used for that.
But if you load it in Rust, you get symbolized output, so you know the function names at least?
I do. So I have the header. I have the header. I mean, it has the C API functions. It's just you sort of don't know what they mean.
Yeah. Okay. So I kind of get the settings. So you probe it a lot and hope that you kind of can figure out
Lot of access violations, seg faults.
Yeah.
And then it was my first experience actually writing any sort of production code on Windows, which...
Yeah.
I will say was daunting at first, but Rust made very, very comfortable.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah. Windows as a production platform can probably spend a lot of time there. Surprisingly common.
Yeah. My biggest problems with it are just really getting it to like behave itself on boot.
Yeah.
It's one of the things that I think that most Unixes are just so extremely good at is coming back up quickly to a known good minimal state of service operation.
And yeah.
I'm sure that there's a way to do that in Windows, but everything I look is like, oh, click in this menu. It's like, no. It's not what I want.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, they just had this security problem where after the reboot, they wouldn't come up again for the kernel update. I forgot the exact details, but that was pretty horrific.
I have auto updates on, and somehow I updated to a point where it said that I needed to like welcome back to Windows and click through some screens.
Yeah.
So the system was offline for like a week while I wasn't in the shop.
Yeah.
And it's just like, and I'm not going to put a KVM in like a butcher shop. It's just, it's nuts. What I really want is like a little Raspberry Pi. And that's just not. One, I have 32-bit Intel DLLs that I can't really easily run. I've tried to run them under Wine, and after, you know, a day of just trying to brute force it, I could not get that to work. So, alas.
Yeah, I've been looking into cross-compilation lately in the context of Nix and in the context of Zig. So both have kind of quite compelling like offerings, or at least in principle approaches to it, right? So you kind of wire up your environment and then the cross compiler is right built into the package manager or in the language toolkit. But so far, just running stuff under Wine on OS X has always kind of, it could never get way past Hello World. It was always lots of sharp edges. And
very, very sharp edges.
Yeah.
Yeah, I found that Rust has been extremely good for cross-compilation for me. It's always been possible. And I did cross-compilation with GCC and Clang and stuff like that in the past. And it's doable. It just requires like rolling up your sleeves and getting grease all over you. Whereas Rust, you just like do the two lines to add a target and you're done. And then it's like, oh, yeah, man, that works.
That's this way. So,
I think Go is very similar. Yeah, I used to cross-compile because we ran Illumos a lot, and we had Go running there. I would cross-compile to Linux and then ship them up to production that way.
Yeah. Any Illumos running in the butcher shop at this point?
No. No. I think I have an Illumos box running somewhere, but not in the butcher shop.
And for the kind of tying together all the services, some web stuff that people can operate, or is it like behind the scenes or feeding the other systems?
So far it's been mostly behind the scenes, automated jobs, doing customer list syncs and product list and inventory syncs and things like that. So for example, I'll go and find all of the orders. So one of the cute things is the loyalty program that we have. We didn't like any of the loyalty programs for all the products. Loyalty programs seem very specific to that product. So if we were going to switch backends from, say, IT retail to Shopify or to Square, we would have to change our loyalty program. And I was not excited about that. So what we did was we designed a loyalty program that gives you a percentage discount based on how many dollars you've spent in the last 180 days. So one of the automated processes goes and pulls all of the purchases from all of the different platforms, creates a stores in a Postgres database, and then updates the discount level for all the customers and all the different platforms to match based on that. So it's sort of out of band. A lot of that's been out of band, sort of behind the scenes routine jobs. But now I've started to add a web interface to allow the butchers to kind of dig into records and things like that. One of those systems is for the cut in, cut out process. So before, basically they would take say you want to do filet mignon, you'd pull a tenderloin, beef tenderloin out of the fridge, break the cryovac, you weigh it, say it's, you know, 15 pounds. And then you would shrink that out of inventory, and then you would cut it into fillets, and then you would weigh the fillets that you just cut, because there would be some waste. And then you would receive that back into inventory.
Yeah.
Right. So we do that by switching the scale to print special barcodes. And unfortunately, IT retail can't read a barcode with weight on it unless it's selling it. It can't find the product. So it's like lots of weird sharp edges with these old products. So one of the interfaces is a web app where you just, you know, put it in the, you know, internal use column, and you can just scan all the barcodes. So as the butchers are doing this, they'll take a couple things out of inventory, print some labels, and put them in column one for internal use. And as they cut stuff up, they'll put it in column two for put back in. And then as stuff gets thrown away because it's either spoiled, too old, doesn't look good, or that shrinkage from cutting fat off of meats and things like that, it's not going to be used in like burgers or grind, then it goes into column three for spoilage. And then instead of the manual effort of scanning the barcodes and entering the weights, funny thing about the IT retail system is that when you shrink things, if you scan, say, your tenderloin and you put 14 pounds, and then you have another one, you scan that and you put 15 pounds, it doesn't add them, it replaces. So if you're not very careful with the things you're scanning, you will actually replace, and you'll have all these inventories that are wrong. You'll think you'll have, you'll instead of shrinking 29 pounds out, you'll shrink 15 pounds out, and then you'll think you have stuff in the fridge, which you don't. This fixes all of those problems. So the weight is encoded into the barcode. You just snap, and you hit glow, and then it does everything. So those are the types of automations that you can glue together with, you know, a little bit of gross web design, because that's not my area of expertise, and a little bit of reverse engineering of people's APIs.
Yeah, well, that's beautiful. That's kind of the sweet spot, I think, for a lot of things. Like, bad English is the language of business. It's like PHP that kind of makes our like rough web engineering that makes a lot of processes work. Yeah. Very cool. Maybe we can go a little bit back in history. And I mean, when we met first, you already had, I think, founded two companies and had like a ton of experience as a software engineer before. I was always surprised how well you know all the different Unix tools and how much time you probably spend on reading all those man pages. So maybe you can just walk us a little bit through your career as a software engineer, how you first got into it and how you developed this kind of proficiency in the Unix environment.
Sure. I mean, I think the core of that secret power is curiosity. Always. Yeah. Started at university. I was a physics and electrical engineering major, and then I kept taking computer science courses very aggressively and avidly. And then I ended up meeting the requirements for a computer science major at Hopkins. And then got graduated, and I never got an electrical engineering or a physics degree. So at Hopkins, once you've satisfied the requirements for one major, you are graduated and no longer a student there without your interactions. So if you're going to double major, make sure you finish in the same semester.
Interesting learning.
Yeah. So I scrambled and went to grad school there. Cause I had already, you know, rented an apartment and, you know, everything like that. So, they let me go to grad school to pursue a master's and PhD there. And I worked in the computing lab as a systems administrator for extra money. This is an interesting kind of zoo of being a sysadmin at a university, because you have people who have no idea what they're doing. And then you have people who are trying to exploit the system. And you have a wide array of users in there. And you have users that are always smarter than you, right? When they ask you, can you fix this? It doesn't do what I want. You're like, I didn't even know the system could do that. So it's a really interesting learning environment. And this was old days. So this was Sonos. So we had Sonos. This was before Solaris. We ran Sonos 4, and then we ended up running Solaris 2.5. 2.5.1 and then 2.6 while I was there.
This is mid-90s, or which time is that?
This started in 96,
yeah,
I think. And then I was a sysadmin for like 2 years there, and a whole bunch of the students that I was with, they graduated and went into the absolutely booming internet industry at that time.
Yeah.
So that was the initial bubble. And there was more work than anybody could do. And when they ran into problems, they were always like, oh, Theo's smart. And they call me up. So I ended up starting a consulting company to help these people out and got a lot of work that way. Tremendous amount of work solving people's problems. Someone says, my Oracle database is down. It's running on a Sun E4500 with a NetApp or NetApp filer attached to it or fiber channel array attached to it. Here's the root password. Please save me. Right? It's like the number of calls that I got like that, where they just read the root password over the phone to me at 1 a.m. We've never met. I'm just trying to get things back online. That also included like Cisco equipment, Foundry, Brocade, all of those things. Like just like the whole data center environment, all 100% pre-cloud. So you sort of had to know how everything worked, right? From networking, layer 2 and layer 3 primarily, fiber, which is sort of layer 2 and down, storage arrays, hardware, kernels, and then software on top of it. And in the late 90s, like, I guess stuff works surprisingly well, but it never really did work.
Yeah.
So when someone's paying you a lot of money and anxiously waiting for something to get fixed, you don't get to say, well, I don't know how that works, or I don't know how to fix that. So that's where the curiosity kicked in and all of the learning happened.
So did you have like any, or how much experience did you have before grad school with computing or with computers?
With computers, I had a lot. I think I wrote a flight simulator in fifth grade in BASIC on an Apple IIc.
Nice.
And then my first exposure to C was with what I called WIV at the time, which was World War IV Bulletin Board System, which ran on MS-DOS or OS2. I ran on OS2 for a while as well. And I ran a bulletin board and had a couple phone lines coming in my computer. I was total geek in school. And that's how I learned C, which probably is why my C code was so bad for so long. Not that the C code there was truly, truly bad, but it was in a generation where like good programming practices hadn't really been developed for C.
Yeah.
So if you go look at the old KNR book, just don't write code that way. I mean, that's my answer. Like, I don't think that that's a good example of code structure. The code design's not very good. Nomenclature's not very good. People don't name things right.
Yeah.
People overcomment things that don't need comments. You know, comment a for loop that this goes from, from zero to max, right? The for loop says that. So you have to, it just gave a lot of, I don't know, not amateur vibes, just early, very green vibes. And then I went to college, and the university, all the professors think they know everything. That is literally the worst code that I have ever seen in my life. Came out of university professors. Like everything was a global variable. Everything was a static variable. Everything was stored. If you were lucky, it was in CVS, right? RCS type stuff. Most of it was a zip file or like a tar file or a CPIO file. Mm. And every time they'd make a change, they'd copy it to another directory, right? It was like that. Now, there are still companies that do that, where you've got, do this dot back dot back.
I've been there.
It's when you go into that, you're like, it's like stepping through a portal in time, because we have such good tools now for change control, consistency management, integrity across systems, all that stuff. And it's just, and they're low hanging, right? It's just like so easy to use them, as opposed to, it's easier to use them than to not use them. You just have to just get a little bit of education. After I got out of university and I started to write software and get peer review through open source, through the Apache Software Foundation and other stuff, Postgres, things like that, I started to understand what better code looked like, what better software development practices look like, what better design, change control, not just change control in the sense of like, who changed this file and what line, but like how should we change these things? I have a set of changes to make.
What
should they go in? How should they be separated? You know, don't make cosmetic changes at the same time as functional changes. Like all of these things that just people tend to not respect a lot when they fly solo. But when you start to work in a team, especially a distributed team that's on different time zones, like you really want to be clean and clear. And I think that that really helped me evolve my respect for clean, concise software development practices.
Just for the listener, I have read quite a bit of your code bio and quite complicated things like this heartbeat context you wrote for the alerting engine and the replacement of the Syncronous alerting engine and the message broker called FQ. And you think, okay, this is a complicated system. And then you read like the code one file at a time and everything is pretty straightforward and simple. You always like wait for the point where it gets complicated and it never really comes. It's all like relatively boring. It's like, okay, the data structure's at the top, then a ton of functions kind of are written the reverse way. So the kind of dependencies are, it's the main comes at the very bottom and then the dependencies kind of are over the functions that use them. And it's pretty verbose. It's not super dry in the sense, don't repeat yourself. Specifically, like all HTTP interactions were always like 20 lines of libcurl. And but yeah, it just integrated extremely well. It was, it still is, very, very easy to read. And changes are like unsurprising. Straightforward, and there's never a lot of complexity at the same place. And yeah, it's still for me really a ideal on how good software engineering should look like. It should not be the Perl experience where the lines are super clever. It should be unsurprising.
I did write Perl for 5 years.
I have not seen your Perl code.
I was the king of Perl one-liners. Well, no, probably not the king. Yeah. One of many kings of Perl one-liners. But there's a lot of things that, you know, large changes in systems that you do with some sort of recursive Perl -pi-e type of line. I like that. I love regular expressions. I still use them, not as frequently as I used to, but I love the simplicity of the directness of regular expressions. I think it's most software engineering has these tenets and rules that are constantly misapplied by engineers with less experience, right? So that the classic one is, you know, premature optimization is the root of all evil, right? It's not the whole quote. You got to read the rest of it, right? So like the tricky part is understanding what's premature.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, sure. Premature optimization is, no, I wouldn't say it's the root of all evil, but it's a big waste of time. Right. However, if it's not premature, it's not a waste at all. In fact, it's a great gain. Right. So that goes for don't repeat yourself. Well, you can't repeat yourself unless you've repeated yourself. So like abstracting everything away and using it once is the dumbest thing I've ever seen, right? So it's like you didn't repeat yourself, but you moved it into 15 different files.
Yes.
Right? And you made a generalized API that makes the changes that you make because you're the only consumer of it. You didn't. So the general, I think it was, I may be misattributing this. I think it was Adam Leventhal. It was originally in the, he's on the Oxide and Friends podcast.
Yeah.
He was saying, like, in order to generalize an API, you have to have at least two consumers.
Yeah.
Right. And the reason is that even with one consumer, you're just, you know, you're serving yourself. Like, that's not useful. Which is why a lot of the code that you read of mine was very straightforward, is that when I was writing it, there was one consumer. And you know what? There might be future consumers, and I will refactor it once I hit three. Right. Like, because when I copy it to the second one, it's probably going to change. I don't know if those changes are generalizable yet until that third person comes along. And then you start to see that really gel into, hey, this is useful. this could be really useful.
Yeah.
So dry is a great example of something that people do when it's absolutely unnecessary, right? You could not apply all of this abstraction and dry stuff and still not repeat yourself because you're the only consumer of your stuff.
Yeah, it breaks the flow in a lot of situations, and it introduced a lot of names for entities that you don't really need to name, and that just creates so much overhead.
I swear, I feel like the entire industry of enterprise Java is like to create files with small,
yeah,
complex, long names that nobody understands how they're used.
Yeah.
Right. It's just so unnecessarily abstract.
Yeah.
And abstractions, I think like that's one of the big problems with abstractions that people don't understand. Is that so? Most of my, like, to put it in context, most of the time I spent my career at OmniTI helping the Alexa top 100. I think we serviced about 15 of the Alexa top 100,
yeah,
the life of the company. And it was all high scale distributed system, all high performance. Right. So a lot of times you're in there and you're like, why is this taking 48 milliseconds? It should take no more than 20. Right. And in order to ask that question, when you have abstractions in there, it makes that job so much more difficult. So I always appreciate ugly code that's more direct, because it ends up being easier. It's easier to really grasp the profiling of that code.
Yeah.
It doesn't do things unexpectedly. So I appreciate that a lot. And I spent most of my time writing code that is very direct. And then in the occasion that my code is very useful, it ends up being abstracted away, hopefully in a way that's useful and not hard to debug.
Yeah, that's a good approach, or a good way to look at it. But yeah, I mean, thanks for creating the context, because I think a lot of these things are in flux. I think this kind of dry thing, it has come full circle. People are aware that you shouldn't be completely non-repeating. And also the Java world has now seen Scala, Clojure, Kotlin. So they're trying to get away from the kind of, I forgot about the rule
that
you
have to have. The Java world's still the Java world.
Yeah. Okay, that may be true, right? But it's not kind of the environment which I am currently. And we have a lot of Go at the company I work for. And basically, there was this radical agility phase where they just allowed everything, which made it a lot more colorful. But we definitely don't have this kind of Java culture where it's just everything is like super architected. But yeah, I mean, just coming a little bit back for your earlier experience, which kind of shaped your style. I mean, the basic flight simulator, I think that's a good starting point. But you mentioned the ASF and some projects you were involved with, including Postgres and some peer review. So what would you like name as the biggest stylistic influences in terms of code bases or maybe peers that you had early in your career?
I'm not sure that there's a big influence in particular. I ended up reading a lot of code, right? So yeah, the one that I hacked on the most. So interestingly, when I was working at OmniTI, I was doing a lot of high performance profiling, and DTrace came out. And it turned out that DTrace is one of the coolest things that had ever happened in computing for me. It allowed me to, without code modification, ask questions that I had not thought of asking before. And that was the fundamental difference, right? Yeah. Typically, you write code and you're like, I wonder how long this takes. Like, well, I got to add timing in. Start, finish, CLAPS, printf, whatever. Yeah. You have that sort of thing. You could do some profiling, call stack tracing, but that's not really asking a question. Like asking a question of like, I keep having slow accesses to this file. Which processes are reading it? Which disk blocks are they reading? And on which drives are they hitting?
Yeah.
In software that I did not write, like Oracle. And then DTrace trivially allowed me to ask that question. So
the only way to get that is usually is, right, to recompile your kernel, put a lot of printk or whatever functions in your kind of virtual file system or device drivers, and then kind of like restart your machine. And that just in reality doesn't happen. I mean,
yeah. Now eBPF allows you to do the vast majority of all of this stuff, if not all of it. But at the time, that didn't exist. And sadly, due to the licensing shit show that is open source, DTrace didn't get adopted across other platforms other than like FreeBSD. So I do have a soft place in my heart because DTrace's safety was allowed you to kind of expose it to users without super user privileges in a lot of ways. Uh-huh. It was such a safe language, such a safe runtime. But yeah, so like DTrace allowed you to do that without recompiling the kernel. It also allowed you to do it without having access to the source code of the binaries you were running, which was really common back in the late 90s because you ran a lot of commercial software. And they also had this thing called user probes, which allowed you to, instead of doing some weird circus tricks to try to figure out like how to grab a certain function entry and decode the parameters, you could sort of lay it bare in the code. And I believe eBPF has this now too, the user probes.
Yeah.
You can kind of annotate and expose structures that are a little bit easier to consume. And I ended up writing those for the Apache web server and for Postgres. And then it provided some tooling, which honestly, I think some people still use that stuff, but I don't even think that that you can do the stuff that we did with Postgres back then today without running on a DTrace box.
Yeah.
Like a DTrace capable box. It's really interesting. So in that process, I started instrumenting other things. I instrumented tons of code, ended up reading tons of code. I read Java code, I read C code, C++ code. I did a lot of PHP code. I didn't write a lot, but I read a lot. Probably the cruelest thing I ever did was had to debug large Ruby apps. That was a certain place in hell. Python and Perl and all of these things. So I ended up just consuming just massive arrays of code. And I think that was more of the influence of I kind of got a feel as to what was easy to debug. Right? What was easy to instrument? What was easy to observe? What was easy to debug? And that mostly influenced my sort of elective decisions in programming style. Because I wanted to write things where when I went back to them later and didn't remember that I didn't feel like I hated the author anymore, right?
there's so many tangents. Super interesting. But like one of the things I was like, kind of most impressed by working with you is your ability to debug things. And just to like, instead of like me, if I have a problem, I don't really understand the box and what I'm looking at. So I was always like try to restart it or try to like, let's install Linux from scratch. That was also always a reflex that I had of kind of the library problems get too wild. But I remember like when I first tried to install the Secundus database on my machine, I had all kinds of library resolution problems and kind of set together there and just, okay, let's see exactly like this is libblass, it's missing. It's kind of expecting this version, it should be there. So let's kind of go to the root of it and really kind of drill down the problem. And I think this mental image I have in front of me is really like a fixture thing. You have something that's broken, you try to tie it down, and then you chip at it and kind of dissect it until you get to the root. Do you have, or do you share this image, or what is do you have an approach to debugging, or can you talk about your debugging philosophy a little bit?
Sure. I think that it's informed by sort of two things. One of them is there's a lot of people who have watched me debug systems. I'm not the best debugger out there, but I'm competent, very competent. And they're like, well, how do you know all of this? And it's like, I spent 7 years in university studying computer systems, right? I took kernel I built a kernel. I built a compiler. I built all of it, you know, like I did all of these things. I worked on multiple different instruction sets. I took computer systems architecture. I took networking fundamentals. I took all of these things. More importantly, I think I retained a lot of that information. So I feel like I have a very good understanding of like how computers work. I'm a little worried for the quantum age because I maybe don't know how they work anymore. But for now, I really do understand, you know, even when it comes down to like, you know, like cycle counts and pipelining and cache misses and all of the stuff that happens regularly in systems, it's all there. Like, so I do have the knowledge of that stuff. That's really important. So curiosity led to that knowledge. That's the important thing. The other thing is sort of like puzzle solving desire. Like I don't like not understanding something. Like it's a fundamental, visceral, like primal urge to like not let something go when I don't understand it. So if I don't know why something, even if I fix something and I don't know why I fixed it, I can't let it go. I still have to figure out why what I did fixed it. Which can be hard sometimes because sometimes the system dynamics change and you'll never actually know. And that's super frustrating. But I think that those two things are kind of fundamental components. You have to have this yearn to really understand, this curiosity to understand, and you have to like put in the time to understand the quote unquote full stack. Right? You really do need to understand like how files exist, right? Like if you're running JavaScript, right? You have a file that has JavaScript in it. It gets read in. It gets just in, you know, it gets read into a VM. It gets just in time compiled probably if you're running something like V8 or something else. That gets executed on your CPU. And all these different things, the how the garbage collector works and all of these things, how the kernel's memory system works against that. All of these things exist in the system. And you have to kind of be patient enough to get them all in your brain. So that's I think that's it. So those are the two things. And then the approach to troubleshooting is really asking good questions, right? It's sort of I gave a talk in Dublin at an Apache conference called Advanced Production Troubleshooting. I'm sure the slide stack is somewhere, but it really talks about how to diagnose problems with like web servers. And a classic problem, you spin up a web server, you configure it, you try to load a page and you don't get the thing you're supposed to, right? So how do you troubleshoot that? Well, my first question is, well, what the fuck is it doing? Right, like that's my question is what is it doing? So you need to have the tooling to be able to say, what is it doing? Right. Well, the first thing that it should be doing when I load the web page from like a user space perspective is probably accepting the inbound connection. Right. Like, so somebody, my browser or curl or something hit the web server. There should be a connect. There should be a connect on my side and there should be an accept on the other side. Right. Is that happening, right? So I could use strace on Linux. I could use truss on Solaris, ktrace on FreeBSD, which are all similar tools. I think dtrace is overkill for that, for example, right? It's just, I just want to see, is it connecting? And then you can sort of just see the strace output, see all the system calls that are happening. And when you look at it, you can see all the files it's loading. You can see all the directories it's touching. You can see accessing certain directory eperm. And you're like, oh, well, there's a permission denied problem there. That's probably what it is, right? So you're just asking the system what it's doing. And when it surprises you, you ask the next question. So it's really just, I don't think it's really the Socratic method, but it's asking the system, what are you doing? And then why are you doing that? What are you doing that for? What are you doing that for? And then if you get deep into that enough, you end up having to open the code up, which is why open source is so important. Because when it really misbehaves, you're like, what the fuck? Why is it doing this? And then you go in and you find some sort of weird predicate somewhere. And but having the tooling to do that, being able to find the system calls, being able to generate a stack trace at a certain system call, like all of those things, they need to be in your toolkit. And once they're in your toolkit, you have the tools to effectively ask the questions that you want to ask.
Then let's talk a little bit about those walls that you're hitting when debugging. I mean, the most obvious one is kind of the Windows experience, right? So you're downloading your freeware executable and it just doesn't work, or the network doesn't connect. And then you try to read it. Like back in the day, the internet wasn't really a thing. So probably you just did nothing and just clicked all the buttons and in hopes that it gets better. And then later you kind of found some forum entries, which are like more or less helpful. And it's kind of this black box where it's really hard to pierce through. And although in the Linux world, it has been like a lot more is possible, but I think a lot of people are still kind of wrestling with this kind of black boxes where they cannot pierce through, specifically just compiled artifacts. So do you kind of have any like tips how to approach those situations, how to kind of peel the layers and to get one step further?
So my Windows debugging experience is sadly incompetent. So the Windows does have dtrace, which is kind of cool.
Since when?
I don't remember. I feel like 5 years.
Okay, well, that's fairly recent.
And dtrace on Windows. The article is from last month, but
have you tried using it?
I have tried using it. It was slightly tricky. So it does function boundary tracing on the kernel, which is tricky because you don't really have a lot of kernel insight. It does syscalls, which are the NTOS system calls. You can trace processes and things like that, which does function boundary tracing in PID, and you can do stack traces and stuff like that. And it also does event tracing on Windows, which is actually really cool, but I don't know much about that. So
yeah.
I would say people who run Windows, if they're really interested in learning to debug, dtrace is a very cool tool for that. I try not to have problems on Windows. I don't think I'd ever run Windows in a complex, a high-performance environment where I was on the hook for making it work. The butcher shop is not such a thing.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. And I do really, truly appreciate having the source code for the kernel, right? So when OpenSolaris happened, that's when dtrace became like the holy grail, because I was no longer stuck at the kernel boundary. I could actually look inside and see what the code was doing and try to debug that better, and ended up fixing some. I think I have a patcher here or two there in the Illumos kernel because of that.
Yeah. So what are the kind of like which areas of the system did you kind of dive into first when those like source code came available? Which was like where did your curiosity lead you first when you had that capability? Why was it so great?
I know that I dug into network drivers a little bit because I've had some pretty consistent problems with those. I looked at the virtual memory management system. I needed to do the mmap function on Illumos did not do some of the things that the Linux one did, and I needed to map those in. Mm. It was actually for LuaJIT, to make LuaJIT work a little bit better. So one of the nuances of the Illumos user space is that the process space starts at zero from a heap allocation point of view, but the stack starts very, very, very high in 64-bit processes. So it's like way, way up there. They're not contiguous segments, so it doesn't matter. But if you're using pointer packing, that's really bad because they don't have the same lead pointer, lead part of the pointer.
You need to know which bits you can mask or which you can.
Right. You can't mask any bits because they're all different. Right. So I made it so that, that there was a, I forget how I did it. I also patched Luigi to work better. That way. I don't think that was ever accepted back, but
I remember some like load scripts you gave us to make LuaJIT work on certain configurations where like I had a colleague of mine with a kind of similar background than myself. We were just like staring at 4 bytes in a like loading script which we never heard of, and suddenly this LuaJIT worked on Lumos. That was
I think that was a linker map script that forced, and I think it forced the heap into a different spot.
That was complete black magic. And we thought of ourselves as fairly sophisticated engineers. And it was just like, we get this 4-byte script and this kind of elusive problem went away, as it was one of the like more memorable situations.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's just the same troubleshooting principles of, hey, this is segfaulting. Why is it segfaulting? And it's because it's accessing this page that isn't right. Why is it accessing this page that isn't right? Okay. Why isn't it doing that on Linux? Okay. Ask the same questions on Linux. Like, oh, it's different pages. Okay. Now I see what the problem is. How do I make it do what it does on Linux? And then there was a lot of digging around and finally found that linker mapping stuff. Yeah. I find the intricacies of systems, I think kernel engineers in general are oddly brilliant. I find that chasing their tails, me chasing their tails, is sometimes very interesting. So there's some stuff on Solaris, for example, that would allow you to, at user execution time, determine your chipset capabilities and superimpose code that may have been compiled as an optimized form for that extended instruction set. So if you had like AVX 256 or something like that on Intel, you could have a version for that, and you didn't need to know about it in the binary, and you didn't need to write any code inside your binary to test it. You could just say, this code should run in this, as it's like a weak function that gets linked into that if the chipset has this.
Yeah,
it was really neat. And like my first question is like, how does it do that? That's so cool. So then you're like diving into the linker, you're diving into all that stuff. And it's curiosity is what drives it all.
Yeah, these are really the dark niches of like Unix programming, the loaders and the linkers that kind of make this processes work.
I have to say, that's one of the reasons I won't get any friends for saying this, but like really, really dislike Go's choice of not adhering to ABI standards for that.
I think the stack frames all over the place, right? All the coroutines are just
they use
the same
split stack. They don't use the x86, 64 ABI for doing their stuff. So it means that if you're going to call into C, for example, you have to like do a special C, you have to run in C mode or what. It's just like, you know, I get you're being clever, but the cost of that cleverness is, it's just unwarranted in my opinion. So it's always, that particularly frustrated me about Go. So other than that, I mean, I like the language itself. I think it's a really nice language. It's easy to get stuff done. You tend to not have the same type of bugs you have in other languages. Same reason I like Rust. Once you kind of get the hang of the language, there's this whole class of bugs that happen in C and C++, unless you're an expert C++ programmer, that are common, that kind of just disappear.
I watched a podcast with Michel Hashimoto, the HashiCorp founder, yesterday, and he actually, after leaving HashiCorp, wrote a terminal emulator. Have you heard of this?
GhostCTY.
Yeah, GhostCTY, and it's written in Zig. And he was kind of a big Go proponent, and just chose Zig for this project, which I found interesting. His reasoning was, I think, more from the enjoyment of the personal experience around it. I think Go is a little bit verbose from times, and
I think a lot of people are just looking for something new. Everybody wants to touch something new. There's that. I mean, I think Go is a very good tool language, but it's not a great systems language.
Yeah, that makes sense. Right?
So I think it's actually a really poor systems language. Because if it's a systems language, I should be able to, with some amount of effort, be able to move from user space into kernel. And that is exceptionally hard with Go. But I think the reasons that he cited for using Zig are a lot of the reasons that people use Rust. People use Zig because they don't like the Rust community and think the Zig community is awesome. And there's a whole bunch of people who use Rust who think the Zig community is toxic and they use Rust. I'll leave that one there. But I think Zig's a very interesting programming language. It has a lot of advantages like Rust does. I think the borrow checker in Rust is a lot to swallow, but once you've got it, it's cool.
When you compare your experience with Solaris and with Linux, also like reading into the source code and understanding on a deeper level how things are solved, like how do you look at those two systems, and like how hard was it for you to move to Linux eventually?
So to be fair, I started on Linux.
Really?
I started on Linux. It was Slackware.
Okay.
I think it was Slack. Was it Slackware? I think it was Slackware.
Linux came out
Yggdrasil. Yeah. Whatever it was, back it was in 1995 or six. And I had 38, 3.5-inch floppy disks that I tried to install. I mean, it took forever. It was amazing. I had it on my 386 or 486, whatever it was. And then I logged into the Hopkins general purpose mainframe, which was IRIX. Thought that was the coolest thing ever because I couldn't get access to it to run on my own. You know, it was the thing that was over on the other side of the fence, seemed cooler. And then when I joined the CS group, they had Alteryx running on their workstations in the lab, and they had Sonos running on their mainframe on their backend servers. And I fell in love with, and I used VMS as well. And personally, I have a distaste for VMS. I don't really like VMS very much. Mm. But I just fell in love with Unix. It sort of made sense from an operational perspective. I liked being at the shell. I really liked being able to pipe things together and construct stuff that way. It felt very natural to me. It felt like something that I got. Like I understood what I was asking it to do, so I wasn't surprised when it did weird shit. So I liked Unix a lot. And then I took an operating systems class, and we had to write a Unix-like operating system. And then when I taught, I TA'd and helped teach the operating systems class at Hopkins, and we taught using Linux. So that was pretty cool. We had people rewrite and change the virtual memory system. So the paging algorithm was different. We had people write their own file systems. It was really a cool class. It was very practical.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, one of my math professors always said there are only three times in life we can really learn something. One is when you're learning it first and hearing it first. One when we are tutoring it. And then if you are teaching it as a professor. So I can also imagine you tutoring this class really allowed you to go next level on this stuff and designing the exercises and so on, right?
Yeah, it was interesting because I ran some of the classes. Some of the classes were out of the class, the Silver, what was that? The Silbershots book? I can't remember the name. It's the Dinosaur operating systems book. It was the classic instructional operating systems book from my time. And I think it's Silbershots and Gavin, maybe. I can't remember now. I feel old. But that book was
not the Tannenbaum book.
What's that?
Not the Tannenbaum book.
Maybe, I don't know. I'll look it up. But the Linux looked nothing like that.
Yeah.
Right. So when you were teaching this and you're asked, yeah, it's Silvershots and Silvershots and Galvin.
Okay.
Oh, my memory is not so bad. So that book talks about operating system concepts, but then when you go into the Linux kernel, I mean, come on now, right? So that was one of the big differences between looking at the Solaris source code, which I may or may not have had access to before Open Solaris, and the Linux source code, is that I have a ton of respect for Linux. I have more systems running Linux than any other thing. Most of the system, definitely back in that day, looked like someone threw shit at a wall, and if it stuck, it was in the Linux kernel. And it was Linus that did a lot of that. The code is much better now. There's still some nasty shit in there, right? And the Solaris one looked like it had more draconian software engineering policies and practices put in place, and you could feel it when you were reading the code.
Yeah.
So it felt like stuff was where it was supposed to be.
Yeah.
And it did what it was supposed to do, and it did what the documents said it did. And the comments were freaking amazingly good. Nice. So if you ever want to see good code comments, the Open Solaris, the Illumos kernel, has phenomenally good comments about the overarching design principle of a certain subsystem, why it works the way it does, and how it works. And the comments match the code, for God's sake. And it's like that was wild. It was the first time I had ever seen anything like that. I was like, oh, it is possible to have comments that match the code.
Yeah, what about the Postgres code base? I thought the comments there were also pretty good, right?
The comments there aren't, they match. They're just not as good.
Okay.
They're not, they're at a different level. They're either at a level where it's like, I don't know anything about databases, so I'm reading the comment.
Yeah.
Or I know everything and it's a nuance, but it doesn't really talk about like design principles and interactions with operating systems, which I would expect, and like the VM system for Postgres, where it's talking about writing, you know, direct IO to files or non-direct IO to files. Like, why does it do it that way? Why does it use the subsystems it does? Why does it work that way on Linux or FreeBSD? You know, I don't think, at least last time I checked, the comments really don't cover the stuff that I find interesting. So I guess it was just like a personal alignment with the Illumos kernel, the Solaris, Open Solaris kernel, is that when I went in and read the comments, they answered the questions that I had.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so seldom that I open a file and this happens, that they are kind of answering the questions. They maybe explain what the file is at all about. That's always like, takes a long time to get a feel what's even like roughly happening here. Yeah. And then the typesetting in ASCII comments oftentimes also challenging. I mean, Sun was such an amazing place for engineering for such a long time. And I think those kind of engineers talking with each other and communicating through this code base, that I think it's likely the output of that environment that we see in that code base. And we'll take a look at this.
And I think that they had, you know, I have to ask a Sun engineer, I think probably more than one of them, because you might get slightly different answers. But it seems like to me they had sort of a benevolent dictator, maybe even not benevolent, but a dictator model over the subsystems that they controlled. Right. So they had sort of a universal set of standards and quality requirements, testing requirements, and things like that. But then when you went into someone's subsystem, like you played by their rules when you were in their house. And they were very selective about who they brought as those leaders in. So that, you know, they had high standards, and the people who worked in their code base had to adhere to those high standards.
I will say
that I don't model that all the time. right? So a lot of my work was consulting where someone says, I need this fixed in 3 hours and I don't care what it looks like. And I can say, oh no, I'm not going to do that. Or I can get paid. Right. So I will err on the side of doing the job and getting paid and not always proud of my work, but almost always proud of the outcome.
Yeah. And this is also kind of good engineering practice, right? To know the requirements and to know the kind of when to use the duct tape and when to use the power drill, right?
Like, exactly.
Yeah. A few things after this conversation, I really understand better on like why you see things a certain way and where your experience comes from. And I really like this kind of coming from electrical engineering, right? Having worked on a C64 on a basic machine on an Apple II, where the systems are so simple that you can literally understand the electrical layout of the things. And there's this wonderful series from Ben Eder on YouTube where he does the breadboard computers. I like sucked this up. And for the first time, this kind of dream to really understand the machine down to the electrical wires kind of, it became feasible, right? Conceptually, I have now a much better understanding of how like a CPU really works. And then just going up and both of us are still like fortunate to have witnessed this time where the machines were really simplistic and you could understand the compilers and so on. But I mean, my daughters are raised with the iPad. They will have some computing experience. They already have some command line experience in Linux, typing in Tux card. They want to play something. But I feel like the stack has gotten a lot more complicated. And well, specifically,
The iPad, for example, and the iPhone, both of them, if I recall correctly, have more different CPUs in them than you have fingers on your hand.
Yeah.
That are interacting with each other.
Yeah.
So it's very, very insane. Complicated to understand that. And I would say that the biggest change is not so much the increased complexity in single systems. So because those are effectively abstracted away by a kernel and most people sit above the kernel.
Yeah.
It's distributed systems in cloud.
Yeah.
Because you don't even have visibility anymore.
Yeah.
Right. The whole distributed tracing thing is so loosely granular, right? It's so like function boundaries that some engineer decided that were the spans.
Yeah.
Right. And you can't. So the problem is with the distributed tracing is that you can't ask questions you didn't think about asking later. Right.
Yeah.
So if you hadn't thought about asking the question, there's very little hope that you will be able to answer that question. So it fundamentally changes the system. What I've been wanting forever was like a D-trace for distributed systems.
Yeah, distributed D-trace.
D-trace. Really awesome. Yeah. And the problem with that is that as I think I probably won't be able to quote myself very well, but I'll say the reason that I quit grad school was because I hated contemplating and debugging distributed systems. And then I started a company and ended up contemplating and distributing distributed systems, which is super unfortunate.
Yeah.
But distributed systems are incredibly difficult to reason about. So the debugging techniques are not just like dig, ask questions. It really is try to understand some concept of state across the system, try to understand how coherent that state probably is, and then understand and reason how that state was arrived at. Right? Like those are the challenges. This is what you do in distributed systems is that I have, you know, in the most simple state, I have a distributed system that's modeled through a finite state automata.
Yeah.
Right. And this is where I am. How could I have gotten to where I am given that finite state automata?
Do you model it as a single one or multiple ones which are like integrating over message passing? Or like
you can model it over a single one, but they are some of the state transitions are over message passing.
Okay.
Right. So it's multiple, it's usually the same DFA that's connected to itself in multiple copies.
A DFA is?
Distributed. A DFA, something finite state automata, discrete okay. finite.
Something. Yeah, but the finite state machine, essentially.
Yeah.
Okay.
FSA, finite state automata. But so you end up having the model of your computer program. Basically, it's state transitions. Usually, so all of the distributed system stuff that I did was around consistency, coherency, group communication, basically building coherent state across distributed systems. So you have an automata that basically takes you from one state to another, to another, to another, to another. And ideally, you're running the same code on every machine. So you have that copied everywhere. And then the thing that actuates the movement between states are messages that get sent from that state machine to other machines. So the question is, you know, how did we get here? And it's reasoning about like, well, if we sent that message and it showed up to 4 out of 5 of the systems, but not the fifth one, you know, it's those sorts of mental models. And and they're mind breakers, and they're hard. Right. So distributed D-trace would solve all of those problems, but building it would require solving all of those problems. So, you know.
So the picture I have in mind, and also some of the experiences I have doing this, is just like a bunch of log files, right? You have your 5 database nodes, which are communicating with each other. You are like logging all the relevant events, and then you have like 5 files with timestamps, and you know, you print them out or put them on the screen, and then you kind of try to figure out like how can this possibly happen. And I think of distributed tracing, and also about this kind of event-based observability that Honeycomb is championing, kind of as a more evolved variant of this. So instead of writing it to a log file, you are centralizing it in the system, and you are not you are using structured text, not human readable kind of lines, to better index the information that you get. So conceptually, I think the industry is moving in a good direction here. But there is this boundary you described before, right? So you have to kind of pre-instrument, and then you're also creating all that data. And with D-trace, you're not creating a lot of data. You're just consuming memory locally on the node and dynamically kind of answering questions.
Yeah, and I think that there are different types of distributed systems problems. I think a lot of the classic microservices interacting with databases tend to be incredibly low. They're not dependent upon state a lot of times, and they're causal. So a user makes a web request, which induces a message into Kafka, which, you know, and then it induces a Postgres query and things like that. So that's easy to think about. But when you are, say, doing like an actual distributed database, and you say, I'm going to do a search query, and when I map that across all of the nodes, when it executes, it depends on the node's perceived state of the cluster. And the nodes may not see the cluster the same way due to packet loss, due to intermittent communication issues or latency. So you have, you know, say you have a 32 node cluster, and 25 of the nodes thinks that there are 30 nodes, and 4 of them think that there are 31 nodes, and 3 of them think that there are 32 nodes. And you're like, and then trying to reason about which ones thought which things at which time and why the answer that was composed looked like that. And you're already there looking at it, because obviously the answer's not right. Because if the answer was not, it was correct, you would be like, oh, it works. But so you're trying to debug and reason about an incorrect or perceived incorrect state that got arrived at. And it's just really hard to understand everyone's perspective in a distributed system.
Yeah, this is, I mean, I've seen some glimpses of this while we worked together. It was like stuff like this gossip heartbeat context, and then the metadata replication between the nodes. And then like, you kind of see how all of this state matters in how a query is interpreted. Working in a Kubernetes environment right now, the interesting bit is I've never ever run into these problems again, because like everything is just REST microservices that are essentially stateless, or the state is separated into a different service. So you run your Memcached or your Postgres or your S3, and just do the stateful, like tricky bit into a different service and just pay a lot of overhead.
Yeah. I mean, if you have one Postgres server, you don't have a distributed system. I mean, you sort of do because it's a multiprocessor, but like those hard problems tend to not represent the same way. And most people who have more than one Postgres server don't actually run it correctly. So unless they're using RDS, right? And then you've delegated all of these distributed systems challenges to Amazon, right?
Yeah.
Through S3 or through RDS. And you are not the engineer that has to reason about that. There's an engineer over there that's looking at ElastiCache and RDS and Aurora and all of these things. And they are looking at those hard problems.
Yeah.
It's just that you've isolated those hard problems behind an abstraction.
Yeah, I think this is in some sense extremely beautiful.
It is
that Kubernetes makes
great it, when you can do it.
it makes it very hard for you to invite this kind of complexity into your code. If you have to kind of architect your application in a way that the pod can go away at any point in time, be recreated and so on, kind of you cannot really manage local state. I have not seen a lot of applications that do crosstalk between like pods of the same application, like this heartbeat context or something like this. It's more like, okay, maybe we reach out to a central node to tell us if we have more replicas, but most of the time we just rely on the load balancer to like decide where to put work. And
People don't tend to have problems where their working set size is larger than a single node and they need sort of low latency, consistent, highly available answers, right? And if they do, they just jam it into Amazon and pay out the wazoo for it. They don't solve the problem themselves more efficiently.
Yeah.
And that's fine if your business model allows it.
Exactly.
I'd argue highly recommend it if your business model allows it.
This is the thing I'm also thinking. I think it's the proficiency you need to debug problems in that environment effectively is relatively high. And the problems you may get mission critical very fast if your database kind of locked up and you're not really able to understand why. So I much rather not have that problem than having the problem of like educating a larger developer a population on how to debug this kind of stuff. But there's still the question, how does Amazon or how do the kind of platform teams operate these things and what tools do they have to actually do so? And I also think the kind of like pods where you don't have PCAP permissions or you don't have like ptrace permissions in the production are not really the place where you want to solve this kind of production issues.
I guess I'm old enough now that I'm not interested in solving people's problems when they artificially limit my tool set.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting to see like the attitude back in the day, right? Just give somebody the root password like without any checks, and then you just do what's ever needed on the box to get stuff going. And just even TCP dump is a super powerful tool if you have
like, it reminds me of Fred Moyer posted what would an Amazon trick question look like if it was answered by Feynman.
Okay.
And it's hilarious because it's the classic, you have three light switches and three light bulbs in the other room, and you need to figure out which light bulb controls which switch and which switch controls which light bulb, and you can only ever enter the room once. Right. And like, it's a trick question because it's a horrible question. It has nothing to do with computing.
Yeah.
And I think that the answer is you turn two light switches on and you wait for a minute and you turn one of them off and you wait for 30 seconds and you turn them all off and you walk in the room and you touch the light bulbs to see how hot they are. Right. And it's like, so the Feynman response is like, are they UL certified? Are they wired with their hot leads in there? Are they all load leads? Or are they some of them loaded on neutral? Do I have a testing current kit? Blah, 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 blah. And the person gets frustrated with them the whole time. And then And it gets to the point where it's like, well, they don't have necessarily the same bulbs. So one could be fluorescent, one could be incandescent, and they'd have different heat profiles. So you can't trust that anyway, right? So interestingly, this is a software engineering job. When I do my job, am I allowed to use tools, compilers, debuggers, analyzers?
They're
like, of course. And it's like, why would you ask me an electrical question if you're not going to give me the industry best practice standards for electrical systems?
Yeah.
Right. And it's a very funny article. It was in the observability Slack channel the other day.
Yeah, it's really a good framing of this thing, right? As a craft and as an engineering discipline. So what are the tools that you really need in this kind of environment? And for me, it's frustrating. And like just inspecting an HTTP payload is oftentimes surprisingly hard. Try injecting a print statement in a Python script that runs in a container. I can fire up, install my Emacs in production. That's fine. It works. Apt-get works. And then I'm editing the Python code, and then I want to load it. But how do you load it? So you need to restart the Python, and then boom, the container is gone. And
And it gets even more difficult, even when you have tools, when you start doing zero trust security systems.
Yeah.
Right. So you do something like OpenZD, right? Which does zero trust MTLS security systems between nodes with a registry. Like there's no way that you can't even offload the TLS in that. Right. So it's like deep in the library, the payload. So it's hard to, especially if you don't have the source code, to get at what is going on. It makes debugging those things. I mean, it is a security solution. So ideally you shouldn't be able to see the payload, right? But it does make debugging just very difficult.
Yeah, I feel like so far there has been very little conversations about how a debugging environment in Kubernetes should really look like, what the tools should be. For TLS and this kind of stuff, you can terminate in front, you can use proxies to kind of have a little bit more.
But it does feel like the old, have you tried turning it off and turning it on again?
I mean, this is what you usually do, right? Yeah. You are trying this as often as you can. You automate the turning and off and turning it on. And you're trying to push every possible problem into the business hours they can usually deploy and use your very slow feedback loops.
And what's heart crushing for me is that it used to be in the day, you'd have a system. I know I'm trying to think of one that we had like this. But we always, we had a process or something like that at a customer that, on Friday nights would swell in memory and then peg the CPU and get screwed up and someone would have to log in and restart it. So that customer was like, I don't want to spend any time fixing this problem. You should just log in and restart it.
Yeah.
I'll pay someone to do that every Friday for 15 minutes. They'll go do that.
Yeah.
And it's like, one, that's demeaning as a software engineer. It's very, very painful to accept that as actually probably a much more economical solution because it devalues your schedule flexibility.
Well, you can also write a cron job that does the restart for you.
Yeah. When it doesn't turn back on, you don't have your job anymore.
Okay, well, in this kind of
it's
situation,
tricky,
I see.
Right? We jump to automation. They always, it automates fuck ups too. So I think the problem is that Kubernetes kind of makes that the natural automated, pre-automated state of things, right? The whole point of it is when it malfunctions, it restarts.
Yeah.
Right. So instead of it, the worst case scenario is it pegs itself and locks itself up in a way that it's still live, like a live lock.
Yeah, that's bad.
Right. That's the only bad state. Because if it deadlocks, it's like, oh, the wellness, the health check went off. Boom, killed it, restarted it, everything's fine.
Yeah.
Right. So you don't even, a lot of times, if you're not paying attention, you just don't even see these problems. And then you have the business argue, is it a problem? Right. And I find those tail chasing arguments to be annoying because it removes the craft from the process, right? You should take pride in the quality of your work product. And if your work product is a piece of shit that can be restarted all the time and no one cares, then it saddens me. I would say, I don't think I can formalize that in a different way than it just disappoints me.
It certainly resonates, but I'm also like really thankful for the improvements and the scalability that Kubernetes enables. There is a significant amount of problems that I don't have to care about. For example, capacity planning and like finding a spot, like having that UI where provision a VM on that machine so I can kind of run my service there.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting when I look at these things, the capacity planning stuff. I mean, we've had auto spin up web servers forever, right? I mean, predating Kubernetes. What we didn't have was auto spinning up MySQL read slaves. That was a pain.
Yeah.
And you know what? You don't do that with Kubernetes. Trust Amazon to do it. So you've taken the problems that the scaling problems that were easy to solve before, and you've made Kubernetes solve them. And the ones that are hard to solve, you just push behind that, the cloud line in a lot of ways. So if you are running your own scalable distributed systems database, like a Cassandra or something like that, it's hard to do that in Kubernetes.
Yeah, you don't get elasticity out of the box. You can definitely run it, but you manage it like you would on a physical server.
Get the advantages you just talked about the auto-scaling, right? So I feel like the auto-scaling stuff, software is either easy to auto-scale or not easy to auto-scale, given its design.
It's not just...
You have the instrumentation that allows you to do it. And the Kubernetes is a set of instrumentation. But I would say that the Amazon Elastic, what was that? The Elastic Load Balancer, whatever, that would auto-spin up your systems image.
Yeah.
Heavier weight, but the same sort of thing.
Yeah, it's similar. I mean, I would argue it's not just the auto-scaling, it's also kind of the configuration and the amount of code I can just like deploy to Kubernetes and never ever care about if this is running or not, because it's just always running. It's pretty hard to get a web front end not work on Kubernetes when it works once.
It solves a problem.
Yeah. And I appreciate it of this. And it's kind of a question that we as an industry have, because there are like so many people that have like made those choices. Like, how do we get debuggability, observability back in a like better sense of the word? And I think the way we are approaching this problem right now, it's really about how much data can I possibly like externalize and send downstream in the hopes of it being useful. And the art of asking good questions and peeling the layers and kind of this kind of fixture table debugging that we talked at the before, right? If I have a Kubernetes deployment, how do I stop it and dissect it or multiple moving parts?
I also feel like my perspective is not that useful for everyone. So like I said before, most of my time dealing with these problems in my career was dealing with people who were pushing the envelope in scalability. They were effectively the Googles of their time, right? So Google was a customer, right? Apple was a customer, right? Some other really, really large customers. And the questions that they ask, I think people, just a lot of them, don't care about. So, and specifically, like, I have some of these requests take 100 milliseconds and some take 80. Why is there a difference?
Yeah.
And I see that most people in a Kubernetes environment, like, they are not anywhere close to being able to answer a question like that.
Yeah, they are not close to caring about a question like that.
Well, but if they did care about it, they don't have the tools.
They don't have
the access, I would say. Yeah. They don't have the access.
Well, I wouldn't have the knowledge to debug this in 95% of the cases. It's a hard problem. Like, it's slow. It's probably the hardest problem you can debug in many cases. And like, really tracing this down.
Slow is one thing. I think aberrant slowness is like when it's aberrant, right? And you've got like one out of every 500 requests that are 20% slower. And they're the same requests. They have the same query string parameters, hitting the same server, all that kind of stuff. They're hitting the same pod, so there shouldn't be any differences between the different nodes. Those are hard questions, and I would say that I, in my career, I was in a position where my customers cared, and I think that the vast majority of customers today do not care. their business value doesn't rely on that, you know, being solved.
Yeah, you really have to understand where the business value is. I mean, there are always like companies who are like performance and latency sensitive, but this is not an e-commerce company or a butcher shop. That's different environments. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. Do you see yourself like staying engaged with software in the next decade, or are you more focusing on the physical aspects of butchery?
Oh, I am not focused on the physical aspects of butchery other than consumption.
Okay.
I've been programming in Rust quite a bit. I pull requests on GitHub still.
Nice.
And I think that, I really enjoy solving problems with code.
Yeah.
So I enjoy writing code. I think I'd like to look at embedded systems a little bit more. I have some interesting projects that I'd like to do in the IoT realm. And bring out a little bit more of my electrical engineering background, which is very rusty, but we'll come back. Yeah. So I'm comfortable soldering. It's the circuit layouts and things like that. It's been a while.
Yeah, that's nice.
It's fun to play with a breadboard and then potentially write some C or some Rust that gets run on, you know, an ESP32 or something like that.
Yeah, it's fascinating what those little chips can do these days with the Wi-Fi or the networking they have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to see how big of a Zigbee network I can or can create. Because I would love to have like a 10,000 node network. It'd be really interesting.
Pushing the envelope.
Pushing the envelope. Yeah, I don't think you can do that with Zigbee, but there are always ways because, you know, that's how engineers think.
Yeah. Well, I will be like very curious about your experiments in that direction. Maybe another company coming up, maybe some products we will be able to buy. I don't know. Or a TTY or something.
I'm advising on a few companies that have some interesting products.
Yeah.
They're cool. I'm excited about some of them. One of them is sort of like actually pretty interested in the OpenZD stuff.
What is OpenZD?
OpenZD is a zero trust overlay network that allows you to sort of avoid having a VPN at all.
Is that something like Tailscale?
But it's in the app. So it's like Tailscale, okay. but app embedded. Huh. So you can, you know, basically dial into your domain and say, I need this web service. And it's like, I know where that is. And it connects you and it's MTLS. It's, you know, it's secure. And it doesn't matter where you are in the world. It doesn't matter where it is in the world.
So in this, the scenario would be you install a desktop application that just connects to your infrastructure through magic, or is it for
the
iOS
idea is
devices?
That you would build OpenZD into like Chrome as the socket protocol.
Okay.
And then when it wants to reach out to a service on port 443 or port 80 or whatever, it uses that protocol and it has basically service discovery, endpoint discovery and connection facilities.
Is it also about like NAT tunneling and kind of getting into places where usual TCP connections cannot, or is it more on the security side of things?
Well, we could definitely traverse NAT because it's sort of like, it's a mesh network where everybody dials out into the mesh. So,
well, here's a complete tangent. I don't know if I want to explore it, but this is something that I found quite important, interesting. Like high level, one of my beliefs is that the internet, the society on the internet has problems because of identity. In the sense of I'm not able to say who is making a request for better or worse. But I think that's the biggest difference between the real world. You can do bad things, but you always are tangibly identifiable in many ways. And I always thought that at the very root of a lot of the problems lies this complete anonymity, and you are able to kind of do stuff without nobody being you can just create a new account and nobody will know like who you were. And certain situation, I think this is not the best way to do it. And Tailscale, for the first time, like I thought there was also with this idea of connecting to a network through an OAuth layer. So I do my GitHub OAuth and then getting access to a network, and I can kind of have services being offered to me as a kind of in a secured environment. Could be a company context, but also with some local companies I'm helping. I'm operating the WordPresses, and I gave them access to the Tailscale network. And one of the ideas I had was like, how scalable is this? Can we kind of create a new kind of internet layer that is operating under OAuth, which is just maybe like a passport that you have to kind of show before you're able to connect, and you would be in a more trusted environment.
Who's the one trusting? Right. So a lot of users trust that they have privacy. So yeah, it's tricky. I think OpenZD, that whole concept is very, very similar to that, and that you have an authentication system, and that grants you access into the fabric, to the mesh network of endpoints. Ah. Right? So you do know who's connecting to who, or at least the person being connected to knows the credentials of the person connecting.
Yeah.
Which is useful in those contexts. So it's definitely useful in the corporate world. So for me, like all of the services that I've had to have on like a DMZ that are behind a VPN that need to talk across to another system, like all of that stuff sort of disappears when you have these mesh networks, right? Especially if you containerize them, right? If you're containerizing your services so that they're isolated, if they're compromised, you don't have access to the network. At all. You have access to like an isolated network that just has a route out. You know, only you're there. Mm-hmm. You're in a process space that's in like a containerized environment and kernel.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't really matter so much where that runs.
Yeah.
So there's still security implications. You can't be an idiot with your design, but it takes a lot of the intricacies. I think that in the old days, you had a set of, you know, intranet apps that people needed to use at home, developers or salespeople or marketing people. And then all of that went into the cloud, which sort of solved it through things like Okta and stuff like that. So you have access to these services through authentication, but all of the bespoke services, you don't. It's a pain in the ass to do like integrate Okta with everything.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
So it'd be nice if I could just connect to my Postgres instance based on who I am. I don't care where it is. I don't care if it's in production. I don't care if it's in staging or development. If I have credentials to connect to it, it doesn't matter where I am. I can just connect.
Yeah.
And securely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not only that, because it's secure, if someone's on my machine and I'm connecting, there's still no secure. There's still secure communication into the process. So they can't sniff the network. They could dump the memory of my process, but that's about as close as they're going to get to getting that. It's a nice concept. So it's not host to host. It's really app to app.
Mm-hmm.
Right? My Postgres client would talk to my Postgres server. And anyone else on the box, it's horrible for debuggability and observability, but... Everybody else on the box, they're like, there's just these two processes that are talking to this mesh network over TLS, and they don't know what's going on.
Yeah, it's like this layers of indirection, right? So the physical routing still has to happen, and you kind of accept that kind of this is taken care of at another layer.
Yep.
And it was always surprising for me to see that this actually works because of capacity issues, right? It also works at like a large scale. Kubernetes basically works this way on a lot of instances, and I was always like. Do I really want to route all the traffic in worst case scenarios through certain hosts? But it turns out you can route a lot of traffic on the commodity boxes without really running into capacity issues. And then,
well, in the 90s, it was really easy to hit the limits of your 100 megabit full duplex link, but it's very hard for most services these days, like your individual Golang app or Python app on a pod, to saturate the 10 gig or 40 gig link that's on the box.
Yeah.
So the capacity has outpaced the performance of people's software in most cases. And so it's not a concern.
Yeah, you can get away with just eating that overhead. And then you have additional flexibility that the layer of abstraction gave you. And then you have containerization, which makes all this kind of like sandboxing possible. So it sounds interesting. I haven't heard of it. I will check it out. And then maybe this is going to be our next conversation, OpenCD, mesh networks, and IoT. Let's see.
Yeah, I'm slowly getting to that. I'm looking to set up a greenhouse and would like a lot of things, both remotely actuated, but also monitored in there.
So. Yeah, we have some common interest here. My wife has a pretty elaborate gardening operations going on. So the thoughts were certainly there. But the execution time and proficiency is lacking. So I think you will be ahead of me in that. Yeah. All right. I would say let's cut it here. Theo, this has been an absolute blast. I had so much fun. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man.
And yeah, have a great...
I'm going to go eat some ribs.
That sounds like a great plan. Let's stop the recording. Bye-bye.